cliffcentral.com.
John Sarnay is with us this morning. He's a trend specialist, a strategist, a global speaker, facilitator and coach, and author, as well as optimist and entrepreneur. I mean, that's a long list of things, and all of them in your case are true. So it's very nice to have you sitting here with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I have many times tried to fine-tune that title below my signature.
It's hard though, right?
It's very hard. I think there's multiple caps that you wear. And in developing a personal brand, that's kind of what you're trying to do, you know?
And you don't want to be tied down to just one thing in 2017. You can't be just one thing, otherwise you're boring.
Exactly. And I think it's a one-dimensional sort of process to be one thing. And in the multimedia world, you're wearing multiple caps.
So I don't know a lot about you. And I do have your book, What's Your Moonshot, here. And it seems to me that you are doing a lot of really interesting stuff. So we could focus on some of the projects in particular later on. But tell me about you. I mean, like, where are you from and what's your background and what's your story? What kind of a family do you have?
My mom and dad are both Iranian. I like to
Persian.
Term it Persian.
Yeah.
Persia has got a much more romantic notion to it. Iran has got a much more solid sort of Islamic...
monolithic.
Yeah, monolithic sort of process.
I love Persians. I have, and I know that sounds like one of those, I love blacks, I've got black friends. But I have lots of Persian friends. I was talking to someone last night about the history of Persia. Mm. And, you know, Kirosh, Cyrus the Great.
Cyrus, yes.
Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes. These are stories about ancient human civilizations that were at the time so much more sophisticated than anything that was going on anywhere else in the world.
I think they were consciously very aware. There was a big kindness in the culture. And if you think about the Persian culture itself, what's his name? Ian Wright from that show,
yes.
A Lonely Planet.
Correct.
They interviewed him on his last show and they asked him which his favorite country was. And he says the people from Iran were the most hospitable and warm.
You know, Persia was the first real empire.
That's right.
And these days imperialism gets a very bad name.
Yes.
But the Persians never said you must have the same religion
exactly.
as we do. You must have the same culture as we do.
Yes.
You must have the same language as we do. They said you do whatever you want to do.
Mm.
This is the king of kings.
Yes.
You've got to bring tribute to him every now and then as
yes.
part of the empire. Otherwise we'll come and beat you down with our army.
Sure.
Which is what, I mean, in those days that was considered standard practice.
Right.
But it wasn't standard practice to be as open-minded.
Yes.
And I still think that there are so many, I mean, there's a huge exile community.
Yes.
From Persia.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Around the time of the Shah and then post that with the Ayatollahs. There
yes.
were a lot of intellectuals and of very sophisticated cultural Persians who decided this was not something they wanted to be a part of. And they're spread all over the world and doing amazing things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you meet up with Persians. Most of them are really successful. You know, they're operators and they do it in a very integral way. So yeah, my parents are Persian. I'm African, born in Swaziland. And
what do people mostly mistaken you for if they don't get the Persian?
Everything.
What do they think? Because, I mean, your surname sounds almost like it could be Japanese.
Well, firstly, Jewish.
They think you're Jewish.
Jewish, Greek, Portuguese, uh-huh. Israeli, Brazilian. Every country I go to, really, I get spoken to in the sort of
well,
local
that's cool.
language.
Then
it is very cool.
Just like all your titles, they can't box.
Yeah, there we go. Exactly. So I don't think anybody can box in. Also, when I do say Persian, people aren't used to that because in South Africa, we're very few of us are here. So my mom and dad got adventurous after being adventurous, making me in Iran. My mom arrived at 6 months pregnant in Swaziland. And,
were you born in Swaziland?
Yes, I was born in Swaziland. And about 8 years old, became a first son of a single mom. And that process really began my trajectory as an entrepreneur.
Your parents get divorced?
Yes, yeah. And financially challenged from a very young age. And just really begun the sort of entrepreneurial spirit within me. I mean, I say it in the book, I was 9 years old and the yo-yo craze that hit South Africa, I'm sure you remember it. And my mom couldn't afford to buy us yo-yos, my brother and I. And that just triggered me somehow, somewhere. And I was like, okay, this is not happening for me. And the trajectory began for me to begin my life as an entrepreneur and have a rebellious sort of track in that. And I feel that a lot of entrepreneurs actually do. And went on to become really successful financially in my 20s. And it all began to implode in my early 30s.
Really? That must have been... You see, if you've never had anything and then you suddenly have something, it's worse to lose it then.
Mm. See, Gareth, I speak about, I do a lot of vlogs, and it's spoke hard. About it. Oh, it's very hard.
Suddenly, so there's and your circles for friends change.
Oh, no, but they're not around anymore, yeah. Really.
Those people who were around when there was lots of money and didn't stay with you through the tough times are certainly not there anymore.
But the truth is, who I was when I was having money wasn't the person I became when I didn't have the money. And so your energetic space kind of changes. But
who was that guy?
That guy. Well, this is the thing. This is what I wanted to just cap, is that you're either running away from the darkness or you're running towards the light. Your action is very similar, but the intention behind it is very different. And I was running away from not being poor for my whole life. I didn't realize that. And there's this constant paranoia that you're going to lose all of it. And I speak to a lot of my very wealthy friends, and they still carry that energy. A lot of them say, I wake up poor every morning. And that energy sometimes, hopefully never for my friends, but definitely for me, caught me. Because if you're always running away from being poor, guess what? You know, poverty is going to catch you again, you know? So
you're creating the reality.
Exactly, yeah. So I've realized in the process now, I'm now building. I'm not running away anymore. So that guy was somebody that had a lot to prove, you know? Also coming from a single mom family, the internal dialogue around not having a father giving the acknowledgement from a very young age, you become desperate for this acknowledgement. And I specifically attracted a lot of abusive alpha males. Who, with any sort of desperation for acknowledgement or desperation of anything, attracts abuse. And so the process that was making money, but being abused by my business partners, having this tumultuous relationship.
So how did you make all this money, first of all?
So from a very young age, I mean, I was doing a couple of dodgy things here and there, not having any conscience, you know. I wanted a pair of buffalo shoes and a no jeans gold jacket. I remember it very well. And, you know, whatever you had to do, you had to do. And there was no father around to tell you otherwise. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I got up to no good from a very young age, but was making money, you know, I was hustling.
Were you selling, like, illicit goods and that kind of thing?
I'm not going to name any specifics, but the people who know me know my story. And I was never a bad guy. I wasn't a gangster by no means, but I was there to hustle and do what I had to do. And then by 23, I got my first business. I brought in a range of shoes from London called Acupuncture Footwear, which were really big. Lucky enough that I arrived at that sort of, I'm an early adopter. I've always have been. And I arrived back in South Africa with the rights, and Edgar's back then, which was a really cool brand, called me and said, John, we've just spoken to London. You've got the rights. Please come and see us. And that process made enough money for me to buy my first restaurant. So at 24, I owned my first restaurant. And when I think back on it now, 24, I mean, I was really young.
Listen, running a restaurant's no fun.
No.
At all. And anybody who has one will tell you it's the most gut-wrenching labor of love. And sometimes it doesn't make any money either.
I think 90% of the restaurants in South Africa don't make money. Restaurateurs suffer from something called stagflation, the stagnation of what you and I want to pay for a plate of food, and the massive inflation of everything, food costs, salaries, etc.
What kind of restaurant was this?
So the brand, the Italian brand that was very successful in the early 2000s, Primi Piatti.
Okay.
And I had six of them.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, so I did really well with them. And I was the golden child, moved from new store to new store, and made a lot of money. Yeah, wow. 24 to 28, I was just flying high, you know. And I had some retail stores, some vending machines. So I was an entrepreneur, you know, hustling up. And at 29, it all started imploding. And
why? What happened? What series of things happened?
Firstly, the emotional space of a lack of gratitude. The arrogance. As a young man, I often say a lot of money and a lot of testosterone are the most horrific mix. And a lot of cities, emerging cities around the world have got it. Men that are still boys and have got a lot of money, they are not good people. It creates havoc and greed.
You're saying you were hedonistic, you were spending money on things that you didn't need, showing off to other guys, basically.
Well, you know, this emerging consumer is very much about this primal desire to be better than your competitors and more attractive to your mate. Aston Martin, Louis Vuitton, these brands are just there to create sensual or sexual prowess, you know?
Yeah.
And that was me. I was playing the game, the M3, the cars, the houses, spending way beyond my means, making a lot of money, just, you know, splashing it out. And just making a couple wrong decisions and not being integral with signing of some contracts and just that process. You know, 20s, testosterone, money, Johannesburg.
So, danger.
Danger, exactly. And so the implosion was a horrific, horrific 6 to 12 months of crying myself to sleep.
So, I mean, how bad was it? Did it financially floor you completely? Mm. Did it leave you in debt?
Well, I had to sequestrate. So, Jesus. So my debt was future franchise fees that I was sued for, which was a hell of a thing. I never knew you could be sued for that.
Yeah.
So I was sued for money that I didn't have, and I'd spent all my money trying to save a couple of the preemies that were just dying around us. The brand had started imploding itself. Mm. There were too many of them around.
Yeah.
Like most brands, you know, it's not a preemie thing. I think it's a general sort of brand thing.
Well, the economy at the moment is hardly a place friendly for growth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, you exactly. Know, but we're talking in 2008, 2009, which was tough. You remember?
Also tough.
We had the Eskom blackouts.
The global financial crisis as well.
And yeah, all of that stuff was
happening. Listen, that's, so, yeah. If you could survive that at all, and it sounds to me like you at least managed to get out with some lessons.
But well, they became lessons.
It took you a while.
Yes, and this book is very much about the alchemy of, I call it the long drop of emotional victimization. It's something we do to ourselves. We swim around in the shit and we don't realize we're actually swimming because it's nice and warm. It's almost familiar to us to be in this long drop.
What a horrible metaphor. I see what you mean, though.
But I think a lot of people can relate to it because they don't like being there. They don't like having that conversation with themselves, but they seem to keep doing it.
Do you think you have to fail to really have stories to tell? I mean, this comes up often when we're discussing how so many of the greatest success stories in the world come from failure, and only through failure can you really express the lesson properly. You can articulate what it's like to go through it. A lot of people imagine there's this fantasy land where people don't fail, and that there are some great people in the world who've just never put a foot wrong. It's impossible.
Mm. So I think there's two types of success. I think some people are wired for success. You know, their upbringing, their internal dialogue's already set up for a certain type of success, or what we deem successful, finance, popularity, and those sort of things. They obviously have other challenges in life. But I think that the alchemy of pain into the highest of wisdoms, and there's a beautiful quote that says, on the other side of pain is wisdom, and the other side of pain is kindness, and the other side of pain is empathy. Because you can't create empathy falsely. And so I've been divorced. That process has made me so empathetic towards somebody going through a divorce now, for example. Whereas before I'd be quite petulant to it. I'd be like, well, you don't like each other. Get on with it. You know, like move away and move apart. So pain brings about wisdom. And for me specifically, you know, and maybe some other people are wired differently. But, you know, pain is a wonderful process to deal with those shadows that are lurking in the subconscious that we really don't have access to throughout our day.
So when you failed and you were sitting there crying and thinking, oh, my God, my life's finished. It's all over. I'm kind of brought back to nothing.
Mm.
It's very easy for a lot of people to give up and to just go, all right, well, gave it a try. My 20s were good. Mm. From here on in, I'll have to sponge off of society and try to cobble together just enough money in every month to live. Because that's what a lot of people do. It hits them so hard that they don't recover.
So there's different types of victims. You know, I think that is the one type of victim that becomes a martyr victim.
Yeah.
I speak about it in the book because I spent a bit of time in martyr victim.
Yeah.
And then I became the angry victim. Uh-huh. And the anger around why did it happen to me? It's bullshit. It's this. And the whole anger became the stuff that really took over for my internal dialogue. So whether you are martyr to it, or you arrogantly inferior to it, or you arrogantly angry towards it, all of them are actually victim mindsets. And I sat in that victim mindset for 8 years.
Well, you say in the book, I was blaming myself, everyone and everything, and I was going nowhere.
Yeah, that internal dialogue was just constantly berating myself. And
but how do you get out of that? How do you stop feeling sorry for yourself? Because it's warm and fuzzy there, because you're getting attention and people are going, oh, shame, poor you.
Yes.
And you feel, well, it can't be anyone else's fault.
Yes.
It's me.
Yes. So for me specifically, ayahuasca.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, we had a guy on the other day who told us about this. So what sort of an experience was this for you? It's different for everybody.
I think the result is similar for everybody, because you get the first time an opportunity to get a real clear objective view of who you are and what ego constructs you've created for yourself. And she reminded me, and I say she, the spirit of ayahuasca in a ceremony. I've done 40 plus ceremonies, and she reminded me that the reason I'm not being successful is because I complain that I'm not successful. It was as simple and as basic as just me waking up in the morning and just complaining that I'm not successful. As simple. And she's given me many lessons. But to get clear objectivity that you are in an emotional long drop is the first step. And I speak about it as the awareness that you are actually sitting in a space that's not allowing you to create the reality that you want. That's first step, because a lot of us get caught up. And I know my mom, with all her beautiful energy towards me, would sit there listening to me ranting about how my life wasn't panning out as it should.
And indulge you.
And that's the biggest problem. And that is the biggest problem. Yeah.
Do you think it's a chemical thing with this ayahuasca, or do you think it's a spiritual thing? Like it really doesn't matter how it happens, but it's important that it happens.
I think the first question is, how eager are you to get out of it? So if you realize that you're in it and you're really desperate to get out of it, or you really strongly believe you need to get out of it, the teacher will arrive. Whether it's ayahuasca or whether it's somebody else or another modality, it's the hunger for somebody to want to actually get out of the space. I knew I was very unhappy. Mm-hmm. And I knew I couldn't make two cents together. I was struggling to pay rent, you know, and that desire to want to get out of it, ayahuasca arrived as the teacher for me. So as far as ayahuasca is concerned, 100%, it's chemical and spiritual. It's a bit of both. So it's not one or the other, actually.
So how do you start rebuilding then, practically? Now you've looked at yourself in the mirror, you can see what your problem is. Where do you go? Because now you can't go back into restaurants and things. You've got a ruined reputation there. Mm. It's hard.
I talk about it again in the book, and it's really about firstly realizing that our minds are made up of our personality. Our personality is made up of our behavior. Our behavior is made up of our habits, and our habits are made up of our rituals. And so what you do is then you start changing your internal rituals. So when you were happy to think in that way, when this situation came up, become aware, change that ritual into another conversation. And it's a minute by minute, moment by moment process where you become aware, change the ritual, aware, change the ritual. And so this process really starts becoming a very clear step-by-step process to change your mind by changing your personality, behavior, habits, and rituals. So I studied a lot. I TED talked a lot. I read a lot, and just really desire to want to get out of this mental state of being a boy. And that's what it really was. Hmm. It's being a boy and wanting to heal the relationships with my mother and father and stop being petulant about my sort of process and the reading of it. And I arrived at many different amazing thinkers. And this process I've just explained to you is from Dr. Joe Dispenza. Mm-hmm. And he says it beautifully. He says, you know, you wake up in the morning and for the first 10 seconds, you can't really remember who you are. And then you become reminded of your behaviors, your habits, and your rituals. And that's the thing, is that we are made up of these behaviors and we believe that this is just the way it is, but we can change them, and just by replacing small rituals one at a time.
Hmm. Is there pain in that process too?
Yes, of course. It's unlearning. A beautiful saying. I use this in my keynote when I do for the book. The knowledgeable man has to learn something new every day. The wise man has to unlearn something new every day. And it's this process of unlearning that's actually much harder than learning. And so, of course, it's painful. But how much do you want to get out of this emotional long drop is really the process for me. It's like, how much do you want that success?
So what kind of relationships did you have at that point?
Very few. I lost a lot of my friends in the process. A lot of my friends. In one foul swoop, I lost 80% of my closest friends for no real reason apparent. I mean, there was no apparent real reason that it happened. But again, it was just the internal dialogue was just suffocating myself, you know, and the people around. And, you know, I do keynotes for the book, and it's amazing the response I get from the crowd afterwards. In fact, people reading the book have been, you know, I was telling my friend last night, they're making these little pictures now and branding them, and they're doing it. And it's resonating at such a deep level because we all have this internal dialogue that is letting us down. And I talk about it in the book, a friend of mine that we started our business career together. He ended up being a billionaire and on the front cover of GQ as a best dressed, and I had no money to pay my 6,000 rand rent. And the seething anger that I had about this, but in public.
Oh, really?
Well done. No, in public.
Right.
No, in public, we all, you know, we
pretend you were so thrilled.
So thrilled, which is what everybody does. But really, internally, I was dying. I was seething at it.
See, I'm trying to think, and I can only relate this to my life. I'm genuinely pleased when people I know do well. I'm genuinely pleased for them because it means we can do more fun stuff together. Like if they're happy and they're content and they're integrated and they've got a little bit of money in the bank, means you can propose a holiday and they can come. You don't have a bunch of friends who are dependent on you, which seems to have been the situation for you a lot of the time. Or worse, you have no friends because you're so worried about conserving what's yours that you don't want to share.
Absolutely.
And that's ridiculous, right? Because we're all consumed by materialism in that case.
Well, I think now I'm not like that.
No.
I'm saying, yes, back then, this guy. And I think a lot of us sit in that space where internally we are not happy. But externally, what this, I call it bubblegum optimism. It's society forces us to always be happy. It's such a rubbish notion.
Don't you see that, though, with a lot of millennials? And I hate to categorize people by generation because it's something that I hear everybody else doing, and I'm not sure I agree with it. But I see a lot of people in their 20s now who have been told a story about how they can be anything they want to be. Life is full of opportunities. You're infinitely talented.
Yes. That Simon Sinek's talk.
The world is waiting for you, right? Exactly. And then there's just this host of disappointments for them after that because they suddenly realize, oh shit, there are no jobs.
Yes.
I'm not qualified for any jobs.
Yes.
I don't have experience. How do I get ahead? Nobody seems to want me. Mom lied. Oprah lied.
Yeah.
Dad lied. Everybody lied to me.
Yeah.
And there's
going to
be a moment of serious disappointment for them,
Absolutely.
Which in some cases can make them feel even suicidal.
Oh, yes. I think there's a good stat around them being the most depressed generation ever, actually, because of this persona that needs to be
created.
And
then you have to see everyone else having fun on social media.
Oh, yeah.
You have to see everyone else's Instagram feed full of pictures of holidays constantly all year and fancy outfits. Yeah.
It's a tough place, man.
Right?
It really is tough. But I think also it's not a millennial problem anymore. I call it the generation flux. And what's happening is that you're an ex-generation like me, but even baby boomers, we are fluxing in and out of their new need states as well. We are also addicted to hyper-recognition. We are also addicted to instant everything. They are more so, but we are also starting to apply our need states very similar to theirs in the workplace. For example, you'll get a millennial calling a baby boomer an ex-generation and saying to him or her, can I wear shorts to work today? And you know, the sort of idea is, are you little shit? Who do you think you are wanting to wear shorts? And eventually you give in. And 2 weeks later, there's a heat wave and you think to yourself, wow, I think I want to wear shorts to work today. You know, so we are applying ourselves to the audaciousness of their requirements and needs. And we are starting to become very much like them. So I don't think it's a millennial issue. Yeah.
I think it's human evolution.
I think about it. If you're 45 years old and your career becomes obsolete because of a new technology, you're sitting in the exact same boat.
Yeah.
You have to now recreate yourself, rebrand yourself. And the security blanket you had around your pension fund coming from the corporate job that you didn't think you'd ever get fired for, it disappears. So I think we're all sitting in that sort of space.
Now, a moonshot is where you aim at the moon, and at least that way you'll land among the stars. Is that how the old proverb goes?
It's JFK, 1961, 25th of May, gave a speech that we will put a man on the moon.
His other great speech was, Jackie, look, there's something shiny on that hill.
true, yes. But yeah, his speech really set up this notion of thinking bigger, bolder, and more courageously. And the notion of the book really is that governments and organizations have had this opportunity to make moonshots. And 9 years later, he put a man on the moon, the American public. And then Steve Jobs, a moonshotter of note in other ways, or AKA reality distortion disorder sufferer. And that's what he's been called. And currently we have Elon Musk, who's doing pretty much the same thing. The premise of the book is that today, with the advent of something called technological socialism, where we're starting to get communication, transportation, and energy starting to become free in the next decade, plus entertainment and clothing and food, all of these things are moving towards almost free. In this new world.
It's like an abundance. Peter
Diamandis. I reference Peter Diamandis a lot.
Right.
In this process, we now have the opportunity to think bigger. We have access to billions of people at a click of a button. Our opportunity to bring together funding through these new mechanisms is now easier than ever. Our opportunity to bring thought leaders into the space to create a vision that creates a bigger vision is now never been easier. So in order for us to want to think moonshottingly, we need two things. One, identify if we're a victim of the future or an architect of it. And this internal dialogue, I give tools of how do we get out of this internal dialogue. And the second part is, what do you actually do to create a vision for the future by exposing yourself to trends, but very clearly categorized and contextualized to help you. You see, I think trends on their own are just great entertainment. If they are categorized and contextualized, they give you the opportunity to really make better decisions and create a moonshot sort of idea.
What is yours?
I'm living it.
Explain it to me, though. Like I'm an idiot. Because everybody's is going to be very different.
My moonshot is to do what I'm doing globally, to share a stage with the Gary V's and the Simon Sinek's around the globe, to think that I'm... Yes.
You're a thought leader. You're changing people's lives by adding value from your own lessons and from the things that you've picked up.
I've been gifted with the ability to be a good storyteller.
Right.
I've honed that skill.
That is a gift.
It's a gift. It really is. And I'm able to talk in front of thousands of people and not be shy about it, like you are. It doesn't irk me. I mean, it's very comfortable. Those two skill sets with the ability to have brought to light my boyhood into manhood and to have catalyzed, or I call it cultivating, the mature masculine within me, has given me the opportunity to now hold energy and not come across arrogantly, but come across confidently, hopefully. And through that process, by telling stories, you're able to inspire other people to want to start thinking in this way. So if I can do this, I am doing this globally.
Sure.
I'm speaking globally and just had a book tour booked in September in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And going to San Francisco, thank you so much. And going to San Francisco to attend Singularity University for 10 days with Peter Diamandis and Ron Kurzweil.
Fantastic.
So just thinking my moonshot is very much about doing this at a moonshot level on a global level and to be sharing stage with the global thought leaders.
John, do you think we have a problem in South Africa when it comes to defining the difference between confidence and arrogance? Because this is something I've stumbled upon occasionally. I'm not that much closer to an answer so many years later. Do you know the answer?
Yeah. The difference between arrogance and confidence is kindness. It's the ability to be warm in the interaction.
From both sides?
Well, if I'm dealing with you and I am
because people throw around that word. I mean, I've been called it. You've probably been called it.
Yes.
Arrogant.
Yes, absolutely.
That's got no positive connotations.
It's got no positive.
Confidence got all the positive connotations.
Absolutely. I think the person who's also calling you that is being invoked and triggered by your success or confidence, and that shows them how they haven't stepped into that. But I'm not really too worried about their perspective. I'm really worried about
the definition to you.
Explain that. What do you mean?
Confidence versus yes. arrogance. So,
yes,
so
yes.
I mean, this is the way I see it, and you tell me if you agree.
Yes.
So confidence is the beginning of the 100-meter sprint, and Usain Bolt goes up there, and he's showboating.
Yes.
He's showing everybody, I'm going to win this,
yeah.
got this down, he's posing, yeah. all that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then he wins. That's yeah. confidence. He right. knew his ability. He knew he'd deliver. So he could boast beforehand
yes.
if he wanted to.
Yes.
Some people would say just the boasting itself is arrogant. Yes. I say no. Arrogance is the guy who came second or third and was showboating next to Usain Bolt
right.
because it's in the result.
Right.
It's in whether you can actually make a difference, whether you can actually win, whether you can impact other people positively.
Yes.
Is that an okay definition? Do you
well,
think
I think
shitty?
What you've done there is, given the history of Usain Bolt, now we know who he is. If it was the first time we had watched any of them,
okay.
and we didn't know any of the characters,
then shouldn't we shut up before we say confidence or arrogance until we've seen the result?
Well, I think the result is one aspect of it, but I think somebody being confident up there and creating a vibe in itself doesn't mean you're being arrogant because you didn't win.
That's where I agree with you.
No,
the part that I don't agree with is the people who would say arrogance before they've seen the result.
Absolutely.
How do you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, but I write in the book irreverence to those people of them calling names is a superpower. You don't need to buy into those thoughts. And so for my version of my level of confidence is, how do I not judge everybody around me? I think arrogant people judge people around them.
So Elon Musk says, for example, I mean, we sound like we're both disciples of these people. I'm not. I think he's a human being and
absolutely.
He's screwed up plenty of times.
Oh, plenty.
And he's wasted billions of dollars.
Sure, sure.
He said, though, that in South Africa, talking about us, there is a huge amount of tall poppy syndrome.
Mm.
Right? And this is what I'm angling at, because to me, there are lots and lots of downtrodden people who've got a lot of emotional pain
yes.
and who've got a lot of psychological damage.
Yes.
And the only thing they know to do is to lash out.
Yes.
It's across the spectrum. There are all these white people who feel victimized for no good reason. There are black people who are victimized for very good reasons.
Yes.
But neither is a reason to stay in victim mentality. Yes. But what we have is, instead of people contributing value, we have people who are looking to pull down institutions, subject matter, discussion, conversation, personalities, even people they know and supposedly love. To me, that seems to be very destructive. You see it with our politicians. You see it in business.
I think the thing there is immature consciousness. It's they haven't dived deep into this invisible container of the internal dialogue they're having. They're angry. They're being triggered. And the only way you can heal that is by cultivating the mature feminine or consciousness within us. That's been a lot of my work, the invisible container work I talk about. You know, we have this external container work, but invisibly inside is, how am I dealing with my hurt inner child issues? The triggers that my mom and dad brought up for me, the triggers of not having money when I grew up, the triggers of being bullied, the triggers, all those triggers are really my own consciousness that I have to cultivate in a way that I can bring manhood about. Now, if I look at Mandela, for example, he became a mature, very conscious person. He was able to bring about leadership in a very different way. So people that are being triggered or pulling down are very much in an immature consciousness state, in my perspective, because I was there. I remember berating my friend internally for being on the cover of GQ because I was emotionally immature and I wasn't conscious about it.
You mentioned masculine and feminine. I don't want to get too down deep into the psychological details of this, but what do you mean when you say, like, a mature masculinity, femininity, tapping into your manliness? I mean, what are you talking about here?
So there's four quadrants.
Gender? Is this not gender. Sex? Is this personality?
So all of us as human beings have four quadrants we make decisions from. The mature masculine, the feminine masculine, mature masculine, the mature feminine, the immature masculine, the immature feminine.
Okay.
And depending on what relationship and who we're dealing with, different parts of these four quadrants get triggered. You could deal with money with a very immature feminine consciousness. And an immature feminine consciousness is, some of the traits are not taking responsibility, or being gossipy, or being caught up in that space. But an immature masculine would be, for example, aggressiveness. So different things trigger us from different places. And what we want to do is, we want to heal all these immature traits and bring them into the light and bring them into a mature feminine and consciousness.
Okay. So, and you have to learn to exercise all of those aspects of your personality.
It's about healing those inner hurt child's stuff.
It seems like humanity really isn't just a struggle.
Yes, because you know what the thing is? When you are in the emotional long drop, you don't realize you're in it. Because the people around you are swimming around in the same shit you are. And so what you do is you keep telling each other that it's okay to keep doing this.
So what would you say then about role modeling? Because I don't know that that's an answer.
Well, our role models right now are still young. They're very young. Our politicians are young. They're jostling for power. Just go back to Madiba. He wasn't in that space at all. He wasn't even playing the game. He wasn't being triggered by what things were being triggered. And you know, when Oprah has a hero, you know you've arrived at some sort of thing. Martin Luther King, very mature in his approach. Very clear about what he wanted to do. Wasn't being triggered.
What about Donald Trump? What do you think of him? There's some people in the world who regard him as a role model.
Well, I believe those people are also in the immature states. But you know what I was telling my friend yesterday? It almost seems like somebody's built a movie set and they've now scripted in a baddie and they've given him lines to read.
Manchurian Candidate.
He's just unbelievable. It's a movie. It's like watching Batman. That's what's going on up there.
What do you think the best lesson is that you learned out of trying to impress people, because that's still something a lot of people get. I think it's that immature masculine.
Yes.
They're trying to impress people. They want to be rich or famous, but only because of how it makes other people feel about them. And you can't change other people's feelings. There's no way to do that. Not by force.
Yes. You know, I'll come back to it. The desperation for something always eludes you. My desperation for making money just never brought money, you know. With strain, it brought money. So I've started writing a new vlog, and it's Don't Chase, Magnetize. And this idea that we need to constantly chase X, Y, and Z. And as a mature masculine, not that I'm nowhere near where I should be as a mature masculine, so I don't want to preach like this sort of person, but when you reach that space, what you do is you become clear of what you want to create, and then you magnetize it towards you. You know, I use this analogy with organizations that I work with is you have beautiful values written across your organization, and you have beautiful sort of statements of what you stand for. But when it comes to quarterly profits, all your sales become rhinoceroses with penises on their forehead running into the nightclubs trying to bang everything they can. It's a disconnect. And so it's really about understanding the difference between the approach. Are you chasing or are you magnetizing?
But there are real practical problems in the world. And what I find often when I speak to futurists, trend people, speakers like you, is that they try to shy away from being political because politics is filthy and it drags everything down. And I get that. But they won't address things like Islamic fundamentalism. They won't address things like the freedom of speech that's being impeded by the left. They won't address things like the return of nationalism in Europe. They pretend those things are macro and you can't change them, but they're telling you to change your own life, which is a much harder thing to do.
So I think there's always going to be that going on, Gareth. You know, I think those things
sounds like a cuck excuse. No, though, but hang John. On. Hang you were on. Doing so well.
No, but hang on a second. So no, I don't want to.
I'm not trying to derail.
I don't want to sideline it. No, I don't want to sideline it.
Good. Then tell me what the problem is.
So I, not that I have a solution, but what I've tried to do very much is develop my own ability to bring about maximum impact in the world. And as hoo-ha as that might sound, is there's very little I can do about those things going on out there. What I can do is every time I get in front of an audience or get them to read my book is give you some insight to empower yourself a bit better. To get caught up in those stories on a continuous basis really don't help anybody
either.
It drags
us down. I understand. Yeah. But wouldn't it be the most noble thing you could possibly do to stand up for free speech or for women's rights or for any? I mean, there are lots of people who dedicate their lives to that.
Sure. But let's get one thing straight. Are you standing up as an immature consciousness or a mature consciousness?
Very many people have on both sides have tried.
Sure. But as a mature one, first what you want to do is elevate your own space to become powerful enough to become a Martin Luther King and stand up there and bring about real change through your own power.
In other words, you have to have sufficient fuel.
Exactly. And the term is self first, not selfish. Is you create that, cultivate that within yourself and then move into those spaces. So for me, for example, going and speaking in front of a global Fortune 100 company in Dubai and getting them to shift their perspective and strategy has to first come from my own energy. And so with me, it's not about moving away from those things, but how do I become a Trojan horse going into, I was at the Zimbabwean government last 2 weeks ago.
Oh yeah.
They asked me to come and speak about the citizen of the future. And I speak and I work with the Western Cape government as well on the citizen of the future. And what you do is you bring in a new perspective.
And you don't judge?
You can't judge because I am totally anti-helping and I don't help any cigarette or alcohol brands. It's just, it doesn't go in my value system. I don't want to help them sell more product. And then I got a call from De Beers and I had the same notion initially. It's like, do I want to help a mining company? It doesn't sit well with my values. But what I realized is that through the strategy we did for them, we were able to help them pivot parts of their business to move away from mining, to look at the future of luxury in a different way. So if you come in.
So you draw the lines there. Big deal. Other people draw the lines at profit. Other people draw the lines far more conservatively and say, well, nothing to do with gambling, nothing to do with sex, yes. Nothing to do with alcohol, nothing to do with cigarettes. And eventually they count themselves out of the market.
Yes, yes. But what I'm saying is that if I come in judging, I then am not able to bring about the result I want to bring about. You can go in as a Trojan horse. You're coming in under the guise of profitability, but actually...
But then that's deceit.
Oh, no, it's not deceit at all, because the truth is that the future of De Beers' business is not going to be fully on diamonds. Just, did you see Mercedes-Benz has just now made a move on Tesla's energy business? It's not deceit at all. It's inviting them to have a fresh perspective that's more conscious.
I'm not saying business is completely profit-driven and without conscience, and I'm also not saying that it's a totally moral and ethical endeavor.
Yes.
The whole point is you decide to draw the lines here and there. Other people decide to draw the lines elsewhere. And what you're saying, and again, I don't want to distill your thoughts if they're not correct. You're saying without judging, you can go and you have your own rules. They have their own rules. You don't need to bend each other's rules. You need to be useful to each other.
Absolutely.
In that case, it isn't deceit, I suppose.
Oh, no, it's not deceit at all. Because again, listen, if you're cultivating this mature masculine and feminine within yourself, deceit becomes you can't practice deceit. It becomes impossible for you to practice deceit. And so you're really going in with a very clear conscience to want to help them have a fresh perspective. So whether it is on fundamentalism or whether it is with the government of Zimbabwe, to bring these sort of insights, to get them to ask better questions.
But what are you feeling when you're addressing the people who you know, they don't care about the citizen of the future?
I don't know if I agree with that.
Do you think that the government of Zimbabwe cares about its citizens? Are there not things it could be doing already? Are there not things it could have been doing for the last 35 years to show a shred of care?
I think that the tone is set by the man above. I think the people underneath him are not all aligned to his values, but are scared to do anything different.
But then why are you talking to frightened people?
Because they've invited me. They've invited me. And if I can plant some seeds that can get them to have a new perspective or ask a new question, he's not going to be around forever. And what we're doing is just allowing them to have a new, fresh perspective on saying, listen, this is what Nigeria's done. This is what Malaysia's done. This is what Singapore's done. Just to give them these perspectives. You know, I always tell people that I'm working with is the reason you become victims of the future is because you haven't been exposed to the information. If I can expose it to you in a story in a bite-sized format, you just get to ask bigger questions.
Look, I'm being unfair to you. I mean, there's no, I don't expect you to solve all of their problems. And who the hell am I to judge? Because I've often said, I would love nothing more than to interview Robert Mugabe. I think he would be a fascinating person to talk to understand.
Mm.
I don't know if we're ever going to be able to get that opportunity because some people are shrouded in all kinds of darkness and or mystery.
Mm. But I mean, think about our own country. I mean, you've got people, the ministers that are in there, that have got great intent. They're just being held back. And I think it's the same with all governments.
But are all people able to do this? Or are some people just not? Because there are weak, there are people who don't have a hope in hell of ever asserting themselves, of discovering that mature masculine or feminine energy. They stay in the negative all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Are there not those people?
Absolutely.
And even with all the best intention in the world, if you and I and all the other people who thought we might be able to help them tried, we wouldn't be able to pull them out of it.
Well, I think the best thing we could do, you've heard that saying, your actions are so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying. And it's that idea.
It's to show.
It's to show. And that inspires people, you know? It does inspire. I've seen it with my life.
So what do you think the future is like? And what do you think it could be like?
Where?
In the world. I mean, I keep saying to people, this is the best time to be alive. I think we're on the same page there. There is an infinite amount of opportunity and possibility in the future for everyone, even for those people who might not necessarily be as energetic and as motivated to get up and do things every day. Because the world is going to carry those people along. It always has.
Yes.
But the world is frightening to some people. In other words, I mean, I interviewed a guy not so long ago who just felt like yesterday was always better than tomorrow
of
could
course.
Be.
Yeah.
Those people, do we have to just move ahead without them and they'll be carried along?
Well, I think they got no choice. You know, this future is coming at them like it is coming at us at a lightning speed. How we prepare for it is really going to determine whether we are happy or relevant or even profitable in the future. I think there's always going to be pessimists, and they've got even more reason to be pessimists now because our news channels cover only crises. And so not exposing, for me, it's really about not exposing myself to that stuff. It's going to be happening. It's like a soap opera. You pick up a soap opera today or watch it in 6 months, it's the same crap.
What's your life like now?
I travel a lot.
Yeah.
I base myself in Cape Town, but I'm only really there about 10 days a month. I'm moving around.
Isn't that impossible to have a relationship in if you're traveling like this and you're
I don't have a relationship right now. Yeah, I was married. I'm not married. I got divorced.
Do you have kids?
I've got a dog
who
I co-parent now because I've got a friend who also travels. So we co-parent our dog.
Okay.
And right now, my career is my focus. And the trajectory is
that. I'm not asking to be probing. It just gives us an idea of the context of the kind of life that you're living at the moment. Because you seem to me to be having a very interesting time. Like, you certainly aren't short of stimulation.
Oh, absolutely. I need less stimulation at times. And that's why over the last 2 weeks, I spent 36 hours in Cape Town, and I don't like to call her my PA, my left brain, Louise. She's like, why don't you just stay in Joburg? I was like, I just need 36 hours in Cape Town just to decompress, to keep moving. But there's no stopping right now. The trajectory has begun, and New York and San Francisco are on the cards right now to
Fantastic.
Want to go start playing in that world. Yeah,
well, that's very, very exciting. And Singularity University, I mean, I spend a lot of time reading particularly the writings of Kurzweil, because I think he's just thinking big picture and what could be next a lot more than most of us. And he's got an idea of how it might change, because so far his predictions have been pretty spot on.
Is it 2016?
I think it's 2016. The singularity.
Yeah.
Well, it keeps moving.
Yes, it does. It gets
adjusted, and Moore's law gets adjusted, and who knows how that's going to turn out. But I get the feeling that humanity's on the verge of something really exciting, where we can stop being animals.
Absolutely.
Organisms. And we can start being actualized beings.
Absolutely.
Start to figure out what's really important, what isn't. And that applies to the whole lot of us, because we won't be able to close the door on being organisms until the last human's through.
Right.
Right?
I agree.
So we got to just hustle at the back of the queue as well and just get them going through that door.
And I think the most important thing we can do is just keep cultivating it within ourselves. You know, bring as much energy and light into the world that we can through our own sort of process of figuring out ourselves better and bringing ourselves more into the space of confidence than arrogance.
What makes you really happy now?
A green juice and an almond cappuccino and a walk in the forest with my dog.
That's it, huh?
Oh, it's simple. You know,
simple stuff.
I say this often, you know, I used to have all the trappings in Joburg, and I ride a bicycle in Cape Town, and I live on a sixth floor with an ocean view.
Beautiful.
Very simple life. And just, I think that's really what maturity brings. You know, it's having less of and really aiming at more experiences and less assets.
And there's a peace to that.
Wow. It's just incredible. Just simply, I mean, I wear Apple Watch, and it was broken. Uh-huh. So I put on my Panerai, which was a relic of my Johannesburg life, 100,000 rand watch. It was the most uncomfortable thing to wear. You know, just having the idea that I need to be wearing something to be showing somebody that I'm successful. And so for me, I make a point now of wearing trainers. I don't wear smart shoes anymore. And with the Zimbabwean government, I was wearing trainers. And that's just what I am and who I am and how I show up. And people love that, because it's just being irreverent and playing into the rest of the world's sort of need to give me the acknowledgement that I've been successful in this and that, you know. So it touches on every aspect of my life. So simplicity of food, a simplicity of clothing. I did a vlog called Ritualize the Frivolous in Your Life.
Yeah.
And so it's really about understanding you only have a finite amount of energy to make critical decisions throughout the day. So what you want to do is you want to really preserve that energy. So apply yourself in ritualizing what you wear, what you eat, how you exercise, where you do. Get all those out the way.
I mean, you're a pretty snappy dresser. You're telling me you just simplify it by not having a whole lot of crap in your closet you're not going to wear.
Three that colors. Sort of black, red, white, beige, or whatever. Blue. And that's it. And that's why I have 10 white shirts, 10 black shirts, 10 gray. And that's it. So the simplification of the color coding and all that, five pairs of trainers. So just simplifying the options you have. So for me, I know, like, for example, an almond cappuccino and a green juice really set me up for the day. I need the pH balance. I need the green juice. And so when I get those things out the way, now I've got real energy to put towards a critical decision-making process.
What's Your Moonshot is the book, Future-Proof Yourself and Your Business in the Age of Exponential Disruption. John Sané, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Gareth. It's great to be here.
And talk shit with somebody.
For a change.
No, I love it. There's so much stuff that people talk about that has to do with practical, immediate, present things. Mm. And what you're talking about is a much more, it's a bigger picture, and it's casting the eye forward a couple of years. And if you don't think that way, you're really just solving immediate problems like a hamster in a wheel. It's not very fulfilling, is it?
Not at all, because you're always putting fires out. It's like, when will you stop responding to emails? Never, because they're always coming through.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I hate that. I try, and this is something I probably need to see a shrink about. I try to clear out that inbox every day, and some days it's just exhausting.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
You're replying to everybody because you feel this burning need to not leave anyone in the lurch.
I'm the same as you.
Not disappoint this person.
Yes.
Not be known as the guy who never responds.
Yes. Especially in your space. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's him. He thinks he's too clever.
And then you're going to bed at midnight and you're waking up at 5.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we're living in a very special time, you know. I think all these new sort of electronic relations, it's called digital intimacy, is us now figuring out.
Got to learn to switch it off.
Yeah, we've got
to. Do you do digital detoxes?
I do.
This is something that everybody says to me is the best.
It is.
How does it work, and what does it do for you?
Well, just to give you a quick one, at Kit Kat, Randy's benches in Amsterdam, and they had them. They had a sign on top of it: "This is a Wi-Fi free zone," meaning that you can't actually catch Wi-Fi under these benches, and they capped it off. So it's become part of culture now. Well, digital detox. I think the first hour is very difficult. The dopamine rush that you're not getting through that process is tough. So I do it when I go for climbs up mountains in Cape Town and in the forest. I just don't take my phone, and that becomes a couple hours of digital detox. But anything longer than that, I do struggle with. You know, this is generation flux. We sit in the space.
Yeah, it's also this quandary of you want to be informed, and you want to know what's going on, and you want to also have contact with the people you care about.
Mm.
So that device becomes important because it's just the transmission device for those things. But the problem is, like, the other part of me really just wants, it craves isolation and quiet and no emails and no responsibilities.
Mm.
And you almost, I found myself driving in the one morning. I still haven't dealt with how this impacts upon me or the world, and I don't know if it does. I drove in and I saw a guy begging on the side of the road. And I was actually jealous of him for a minute.
Wow.
That's terrible, because he's by no means as fortunate,
privileged.
As privileged, as invested in being as I am. In every box, I kind of tick things in the right direction.
Mm.
And he doesn't. It must be awful. Survival mode.
Mm.
I find myself going, well, he doesn't have to worry about paying staff. He doesn't have to be up at a certain time every day. His biggest thing is just get enough in the belly to make it to the end of the day.
Well, I mean, he's in a different layer of the Maslow hierarchy of needs.
But you understand.
Like, sure.
Does that sound ridiculous to you?
I think it depends what mood you're in, Gareth. When you're tired, I think that sounds fantastic. I think, but you're also trying to change the world, you know, and that comes with responsibility.
Shit.
So,
Let me not make this your problem.
No, I think it's a great problem to have. So congratulations.
All right, What's Your Moonshot is the book. John, thanks so much for the talk.
Thank you, Gareth.
Good man. CliffCentral.com.